Professor John Inazu, as you know from the bio, is an associate professor of law and political science at Washington University of St. Louis. His law degree is from Duke University, his undergrad degree is from Duke University, and his PhD in political science is from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I ask him, when Carolina and Duke play in basketball, who does he pull for? He's a former Cameron crazy. Actually painted his body, I think, when he was an undergrad there and stood on the sidelines with the other Duke fans.
Off the record.
Yes, off the record. Might be too late. Yes. Professor Inazu's first book is called Liberty's Refuge, The Forgotten Freedom of Assembly, published by Yale University Press. He has a new book coming out. It looks like it's going to be with the University of Chicago Press, called Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. Confident Pluralism. So when would that be out, John?
I think it's not formally approved, but it would be the spring 16 list if it happens. So that'd be early 16.
Excellent.
Or late,
okay.
15.
Confident Pluralism, ladies and gentlemen. John, thank you so much for joining us on this very timely topic, and then I'll be running a list, and some of you have already gotten on it already over lunch. You told me to put you on.
Great.
Right, EJ? Got you on the list right away.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you all. The assigned topic, religious liberty in the American culture wars, I would say, since Michael gave the topic to me, has taken on some increased significance. I usually spend March checking out of work and watching Duke play, but since Duke went to Indiana this year, right around the time of the RFRA, it was hard to avoid work, and so here we are a couple weeks later. I want to actually begin by narrowing this topic in two ways, and I hope both of these reflect fidelity to the original wording. The first is to note that the American culture wars largely means gay rights and abortion, at least in the current moment, and particularly with respect to this topic of religious liberty. So I want to suggest two important qualifiers to that recasting. First, I think we're likely to see transgender issues added to the mix in the coming years, and this is going to bring conceptual challenges in both directions. It will put pressure on progressive appeals to more abstract notions of equality, and we can see these kinds of challenges illustrated in Ruth Padower's fascinating article last fall about transgender students at Wellesley College. In the other direction, we're going to see increased pressure on conservative religious ethics insofar as transgender issues raise questions distinct from sexual practices. But transgender issues, I don't think, have yet migrated to the center of these culture wars conflicts. The second qualifier about recasting or narrowing this focus is that the broader culture wars, I don't think, really are confined to sex. Sex gives us the headlines, but there are questions lurking nearby about transcendence, autonomy, technology, class, education, and race, which are connected and in some ways broaden these conflicts. These issues deserve a lot more attention, but today, and given the time constraints and also the particular focus on religious liberty, I'm going to focus on gay rights and abortion, and mostly gay rights. The other way to narrow the topic today is to note that in the context of the American culture wars, the category of religious liberty really means mostly the legal and policy concerns of conservative Catholics and evangelicals. That is to say, religious liberty challenges are largely, though not entirely, affecting conservative Christians, and they are largely, though not entirely, affecting white conservative Christians, at least for the moment. Now, I don't mean for this observation to suggest that religious liberty is only for white conservative Christians. The Supreme Court's most recent religious liberty decision earlier this year upheld the statutory right of a Muslim man to grow a religious beard in prison. And the history of religious free exercise doctrine owes much of its content to religious minorities like Mormons, Christian Scientists, Native American spiritualists, and of course the Jehovah's Witnesses, which give us most of our free exercise case law. But the faces of today's most prominent religious liberty cases are all white Christians. Hosanna Tabor, Hobby Lobby, the New Mexico photographer, the Washington florist, and the Indiana pizza makers, to name just a few of them. I've tried hard to brainstorm a clever shorthand description for this group, but I came up empty, so I'm just going to adopt the label that others have used, which is the traditionalists. I think that's a bit clunky, but it won't be as bad or verbally ambiguous as the nuns. A few things about the traditionalists. First, they're not really only white. I'm going to generalize here for expediency in calling them white traditionalists, but there are some important multi-ethnic traditionalist institutions. And second, the traditionalists aren't just old men. They include substantial numbers of women and young people as well. Now, this twofold revision to the title of Religious Liberty in the American Culture Wars gives us something like traditionalists in the ongoing conflict over gay rights and abortion. Having perhaps hijacked, Michael, the topic of my reframing of it, I'd like to focus on three challenges confronting traditionalists, and I hope that these will also shed light on the broader topic at hand. The first challenge is cultural, the inability of traditionalists to connect with other people of faith who share similar views on contested cultural issues. I'll talk here, too, about the related challenge of insular discourse, the inability of traditionalists to see that some of their discourse lacks traction in a wider culture, including legal, political, and media circles. The second challenge is legal, the problem with free exercise doctrine and the current weaknesses of alternative legal doctrines like the right of association. And the third challenge is institutional, the practical concerns of how to sustain traditionalist institutions in the current cultural climate. Now, lurking in the background of all of these challenges and soon to be foregrounded is the Jim Crow analogy. Whether today's traditionalists are equivalent to segregationists, and particularly whether traditionalist views about sexuality and the boundaries, the membership boundaries that follow from those, are analogous to race-based discrimination in the Jim Crow South. That comparison also foregrounds the question of remedy, whether the extraordinary legislative and judicial responses to Jim Crow should be deployed today. I want to call this the Bob Jones question, and I'll return to it throughout our discussion. So let me start with the cultural challenge for traditionalists, and that's insularity. Traditionalists are not the only religious believers at odds with progressive politics on gay rights and abortion. Many conservative Jews and Muslims share their social views, but conservative Jews and Muslims have mostly stayed out of the culture wars, and traditionalists, somewhat oddly, don't always see them as allies. One of the many ironies playing out today is the tone deafness of some, though not all traditionalists, to the civil liberties challenges that American Muslims confront because of their faith. The challenge of insularity is even more striking within Christianity. Black evangelicals, Latino Pentecostals, and other socially conservative Christian minority groups share many traditionalist views. But they have not engaged the culture wars battles, in part because Republican positions on race, poverty, and immigration always prevented those groups from climbing onto the bandwagon of the religious right. The inability of traditionalists to form alliances with other socially conservative believers, both fellow Christians and believers of other faiths, has left a lot of Americans without a side, but also without a voice in the current cultural conflicts. Not wanting to join the front lines of the culture wars with the traditionalists, but not either substantively aligned with progressive sexual ethics. Black evangelicals exemplify the traditionalist failure to forge partnerships, particularly in light of the Bob Jones question. Efforts to distinguish Jim Crow from the present day will almost certainly need to be made at the level of culture and law, and white traditionalists are unlikely to make those arguments by themselves. Sure, there were traditionalists supporting the efforts for the abolition of slavery and later helping to lead the civil rights era, but plenty of traditionalists were on the other side of those issues. Some of the very buildings that house today's traditionalist schools once housed segregationist academies. That's part of the reason the Bob Jones question carries so much weight against traditionalists. Meanwhile, black evangelicals are usually absent from the current public debates over religious liberty and the culture wars. They are ignored by some progressives who don't want them to articulate differences between Jim Crow and the present day, and they are ignored by traditionalists who have failed to establish meaningful relationships with them. My sense is even that some traditionalists are waiting for black evangelicals to figure out the current cultural moment and draw near to them in a spirit of solidarity. My guess is that black evangelicals have a pretty good handle on the current moment, and I think they're also less anxious about it than the traditionalists. At least some of the traditionalist anxiety is a worry about a loss of cultural and political significance. Nor is there much incentive for black evangelicals to butt heads with progressives, religious or otherwise. It's not that most progressives care what black evangelicals have to say about sexuality, but progressives can at least credibly claim that black lives matter some of the time. We've seen this play out most recently in the journey from Ferguson to Baltimore. Progressives, religious and otherwise, have recognized that the deaths of young black men point to something far greater than individual actions and isolated grand jury decisions. Traditionalists have largely been silent on the issue, or worse, deny the significance of the underlying issues altogether. The traditionalist response and non-response to the Ferguson moment has not gone unnoticed, and it will heighten the insularity challenge for traditionalists. Now, while I'm on the topic of insularity, it's worth mentioning a contrasting phenomenon on the other side of the culture wars. There's been an uptick, I think, in the coordination between LGBT advocates and abortion advocates. Those alliances are informing and underwriting legislative initiatives, academic conferences, amicus briefs, and a host of other efforts. The partnerships are striking in their depth as well as their efficiency. It may be that they're driven by demographic trends on different issues, with perhaps abortion advocates looking to align more strongly with gay rights against a common traditionalist foe. But whatever the reason, the alliance seems to be having success in a number of areas. One of the progressive alliance that's worth mentioning is the recent warming of some, but not all, LGBT groups to big business. It wasn't that long ago we saw progressive outrage over the ideas of the Expressive Corporation and Citizens United and Hobby Lobby. But the role of Angie's List, Salesforce, and Apple in Indiana seems to have laid aside some of those tensions in at least some circles. So enough on insularity of relationships for the traditionalists and the forging of relationships in the other direction. I also want to talk about the additional problem of traditionalist insularity in discourse and their seeming inability to recognize that some discourse will not effectively translate into broader cultural debates. Let me be precise about what I mean here and then give a couple of examples. I don't mean to suggest that traditionalists should mute the content or mode of their expression. To the contrary, I think discourse constraints based on notions of public reason or political correctness are deeply misguided. Traditionalists, like everyone else, should be able to make arguments on their own terms. But my sense is that a good deal of traditionalist discourse is self-consciously a strategy of cultural engagement, and some of that engagement will have little traction in broader culture. Let me mention three examples of this observation. First, in the gay rights context, the argument that traditionalist institutions impose membership boundaries based on sexual conduct, not sexual orientation. Most traditionalists today focus on these conduct restrictions. They would welcome anyone to their groups, but ask gays and lesbians to abstain from acting on their orientation, and they would say just as they ask unmarried heterosexuals to abstain. The basic distinction between conduct and orientation is theologically significant and makes sense to many traditionalists, but it's largely a cultural and legal loser. Some celibate gay and lesbian Christians retain the distinction in their own lives, but far more gays and lesbians reject it. And in 2010, a majority of the Supreme Court concluded that the conduct versus orientation distinction was legally irrelevant in the context of the membership requirements of a private group. Now, I think that actually the court's conclusion there is flawed in that particular context as opposed to a state-centered law and definition that we saw in something like Lawrence against Texas, and that it's different when we're talking about a private group, but the justices haven't yet asked me for my opinion on that point. A second example of insular discourse is an implicit and sometimes explicit desire of some traditionalists to return to the good old days. Some traditionalists argue that America, as we now find it, is in a less coherent age and that things were more understandable in an earlier era. I think there's some truth to this argument in some dimensions, and we do have important questions to ask about what fills the content of something like the category of morality in a secular society. But when traditionalists argue for a return to coherence, they encounter a serious problem of when and to what they'd like to return. It turns out that earlier times were not so coherent for African Americans, for Japanese Americans, for religious minorities, for women, for gays and lesbians. A greater awareness of the pluralism that actually exists in our country puts pressure on coherence, but it also does a lot of good, and traditionalists who focus only on coherence miss some of the good. This brings me to my third example of insular discourse. While some traditionalists reject or resist pluralism as a threat to coherence, others seem to be drawn to particular theological visions of pluralism that are unlikely to translate into broader discourse. And so, for example, George Marsden, at the end of a book on the 1950s, argues that Americans should adopt a version of Abraham Kuyper's pluralism. Kuyper's theory, according to Marsden, sees different structures of society as, quote, reflecting a God-ordained ordering of social reality that people of all faiths could recognize as beneficial, and he includes various institutions with their own authority, each in its own sphere. That kind of argument has a lot of traction in some traditionalist circles, and it goes back for several decades. It's a nice vision as far as it goes, but it hinges on these explicitly theological premises. Marsden suggests that this kind of pluralism, although developed in a theological framework, would, in his words, be compatible with many other outlooks and would help provide an alternative to the culture wars mentality that has plagued American life for the past generation. I'm not so sure. If we're going to have an alternative to the culture wars, I think we at least need a language that both sides can understand. There are some arguments for pluralism that could do that, but I don't see it in Kuyper. That's all for the cultural insularity of the traditionalist. The second challenge I want to highlight is that of legal doctrine. And here I'd like to suggest that the current doctrine protecting the free exercise of religion is largely a patchwork doctrine. The ministerial exception case, Hosanna Tabor, from 2012, and the recent Hobby Lobby decision are both seen as wins for religious liberty and wins for traditionalists, but the overall trajectory of religious liberty seems to me to be on the decline, at least doctrinally. The main culprit is employment division against Smith, the 1990 Peyote case that led to the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I think one way to think about the history of religious liberty since 1990 is as a patchwork response to Smith and various statutory and legal disputes. Now, I don't want to suggest that the importance of religious liberty as an abstract ideal has lost its cultural or political significance. We have polling data that suggests that most Americans value religious liberty generally, and our government continues to advocate for religious freedom around the globe. But the popular and rhetorical support along these lines, I think, belies the likely fact that fewer people today recognize the immediate need of legal protections on free exercise doctrine. One reason for this case may be that religious liberty has been a victim of its own success. Many past challenges to religious freedom are no longer active threats. We don't impose blasphemy laws. We don't force people to make compelled statements of belief. We don't impose taxes to support the training of ministers. These changes mean that, as a practical matter, many Americans no longer depend upon the free exercise right for their religious liberty. They are free to practice religion without governmental constraints. I think the clearest example of this, the least threatened religious believer in America, is the progressively oriented Christian, who at once remains a part of the dominant historical and cultural faith in the United States, but his views are largely aligned with contemporary liberal values. It's hard to think of many aspects of progressive Christian belief and practice that confront government regulation in a way that implicates religious liberty. Now, I want to be careful here. I don't mean to suggest that progressive Christians hold no views antithetical to government interests. For example, many elements of the so-called religious left challenge American policy on war, criminal law, immigration, and the environment. But most of these arguments pose few questions about the boundaries of free exercise. They are religiously informed policy arguments, not religious free exercise claims. There are also a growing number of Americans, a subset of the nones, who are either actually or functionally non-religious and may therefore feel no need for free exercise protections. This group is still relatively small, but it is not insignificant, and it is growing. And more importantly, this group has moved from being almost imperceptible in the late 18th century to sociologically significant today. It is no longer possible to ignore non-believers in framing normative and legal religious liberty arguments, particularly in cases implicating the Establishment Clause. That reality, for example, is evident in the growing recognition that even so-called non-sectarian prayers are incapable of accommodating atheists. Today, both the non-religious and mainstream religious progressives may be less inclined to worry about the contested boundaries of free exercise, at least in some cases, and especially when they might be antithetical to other interests. The Indiana RFRA controversy may be a good indicator. Consider, for example, how some commentators began adding scare quotes to the phrase religious liberty. It's one thing to conclude that the constitutional value of religious liberty should be outweighed by another constitutional value like equality. But something different is happening when we put religious liberty in scare quotes. To be sure, the rhetoric on both sides of the Indiana controversy bordered on the absurd. Conservative radio host Mark Levin contended that opponents of the bill hated America, and Family Research Council President Tony Perkins argued that revising the law would gut religious freedom. And in the other direction, Tim Cook called the Indiana law an effort to enshrine discrimination, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in Time suggested that the Indiana RFRA was a step toward establishing an American version of Sharia law. Meanwhile, the crux of the actual legal debate seemed to be whether a few Christian florists and cake bakers and apparently one hapless pizza joint should be permitted to refuse to provide their services for a same-sex wedding. That question is not unimportant, and it's important and weighty in both directions, but regardless of one's view on the merits, the policy implications do not come close to the surrounding rhetoric. I think that Doug Laycock was right to assert that the Indiana RFRA has been misunderstood by some people and deliberately distorted and lied about by others. That's a bad sign of the debates that are still to come, and it might indicate continued or even growing pressures on claims for religious liberty. On the other hand, even if I am right about the decline in cultural support for the free exercise of religion or religious liberty more generally, there are two important reasons that I think this is overstated and does not mean by any means the functional end of religious liberty protections. The first is that the Supreme Court has continued to recognize constitutional protections for religious groups, at least insofar as those groups look something like churches or other bodies of worship. The key case is Hosanna Tabor from 2012, in which a unanimous court recognized a ministerial exception to employment discrimination laws. The court located that exception in the First Amendment's free exercise and establishment clauses. The justices made clear that the ministerial exception provides an absolute protection for churches to hire and fire ministers on any basis. They were far less clear about what qualifies as a church and who qualifies as a minister. Importantly, too, the opinion in Hosanna Tabor never really squares the circle with the Peyote case, Employment Division against Smith. The court never convincingly explains why Smith's rule about neutral laws of general applicability did not apply to the neutral law of general applicability at issue in Hosanna Tabor. So in other words, the protections that Hosanna Tabor gives to religious groups are neither precisely defined nor entirely coherent, but they are real protections, and they mitigate some of the cultural pressures on the free exercise rights. The second reason to seek continued protections for religious free exercise is that our shared constitutional heritage properly acknowledges that religious belief and practice fall squarely within other civil liberties that we protect under the First Amendment. Indeed, religious individuals and groups have long been paradigmatic of the dissent that frames the need for these other rights, or what the Supreme Court called the right to differ. Much of our history has been shaped by dissenting religious groups, and that continues to be the case today. So even if the category of religious liberty is losing some of its cultural and constitutional traction, there are protections available for religious groups at the core of these other rights. My sense is that traditionalists will be better off engaging with these issues of dissent, nonconformity, and pluralism, although not Kuiper's version of pluralism. Part of that focus will require greater attention to First Amendment rights of speech and association, or as I argued in my first book, the right of assembly. These other rights focus more centrally on the importance of dissent and difference without appealing to a kind of religious exceptionalism. To put it slightly differently, it may be that the values that undergird speech, assembly, and association draw from a history with greater current cultural appeal than the values underlying the free exercise rights. In fact, these other rights have historically protected many non-religious progressive groups, and of particular relevance here are protections extended to gay social clubs and gay student groups during the early gay rights movement. But there is also a doctrinal problem in the move to these other rights, and it lies in the right of association. Some of you may recall in Hosanna Tabor that the Obama administration proposed the right of association as a sufficient protection for the church in that case. All nine justices rejected that argument, and I think part of the reason for the lack of appeal was a lack of coherence in the doctrine around the right of association. To my mind, the problems with this doctrinal incoherence begin in a 1984 decision called Roberts against United States JCs, when the Supreme Court recognized two distinct flavors of association, intimate association and expressive association. According to the court, intimate association is an intrinsic feature of the right of association. It focuses on highly personal relationships and deep attachments and commitments. That sounds promising, but courts have drawn its limits quite narrowly. In practice, the right of intimate association only extends to close family relationships. Courts have refused to extend its protections even to small social groups or tightly knit religious groups. And interestingly, the close family relationships that do qualify as intimate associations are already well protected under other Supreme Court doctrines. For example, special protections for spouses and parent-child relationships. For this reason, we have a right of intimate association that actually turns out to be almost meaningless, that doesn't offer any protections to any real groups not otherwise protected. In other words, it offers very little to the balance of civil liberties. The other flavor of association is expressive association, and this does more constitutional work. The basic idea here is that a group is expressive and eligible for constitutional protection if it is pursuing some other First Amendment interests, like speech or press or religion. The group, in other words, must facilitate one of these interests in order to qualify for greater constitutional protection. But this category of expressive association comes with a corollary, and that is that some groups are non-expressive. Non-expressive association obscures the fact that any act of associating has expressive potential. Joining, gathering, speaking, or not speaking can all be expressive, and many groups that might seem from the outside to be non-expressive could in fact articulate an expressive intent if asked. And the legal consequences of this distinction between expressive and non-expressive are striking. If you have a law that affects a non-expressive association, it need only pass rational basis scrutiny, which means that almost any law will survive that threshold. That means a non-expressive group can be regulated for almost any reason. And there are other problems with expressive association. Even groups that do qualify under that category are not always protected constitutionally. In the JC's case, the court concluded that the all-male JC's was an expressive association, but turning to Minnesota's interest in eradicating gender discrimination, the court decided that the expressive association claim failed. There wasn't in the case much analysis about why the JC's was practically impeding that interest or the precise policy implications of what eradicating gender discrimination would look like in Minnesota. And the consequences were significant for the JC's. It meant that they could no longer exist in their current form. I think some of this reasoning underlied part of the court's reticence to rely upon the doctrine in Hosanna-Tabor. So now I've suggested that not only the free exercise right is in trouble, but also that association might also be. My hunch, and it's really only a hunch, is that association has a greater likelihood of being rehabilitated today, and that's largely because the protections that it could offer could benefit not only religious groups, but also non-religious groups. And it's plausible, perhaps even likely, that at some point down the road, non-religious groups that appear to be culturally ascendant today will one day need these same protections against majoritarian norms. So let me turn finally to the third challenge, which is the challenge of traditionalist institutions. Here I want to suggest that traditionalists are now experiencing a new level of vulnerability at their own doorsteps. To be sure, there are some traditionalists that have felt embattled for some time, and I suppose that we could plausibly view the loss of public religious displays and public prayers as a kind of challenge to a religion, particularly for people who had grown accustomed to those displays and those prayers. But to return to the culture wars metaphor, the past few years have seen a rapid change in the front lines of that war. Notwithstanding some cases, like the recent Town of Greece decision involving public prayer before a local government meeting, most high-profile religious liberty cases today focus on free exercise, not establishment. Traditionalists have spent the past decades fighting about monuments and prayer, only to discover that they've been outflanked and now find their fallback positions under attack. Setting aside the overblown rhetoric in all directions, there does seem to be a real difference in framing religious liberty in American culture wars when the battle lines have moved from issues like school prayer and vouchers, or even cake bakers and florists, to questions of whether religious student groups can be on public university campuses, whether religious colleges should be accredited, and whether local school systems should accept volunteer support from churches and ministries. These challenges pose significant challenges for traditionalist institutions, especially because traditionalists will soon be alone in imposing membership and leadership restrictions that affect gays and lesbians. Unlike gender-based distinctions, which continue to persist in lots of non-religious institutional contexts, there will be no secular institutional analog to traditional views about sexuality and marriage. It seems to me, then, that a great deal hinges on the Bob Jones question. If Jim Crow really is the proper analogy and the proper baseline, then most of the questions raised by Ross Douthat and others are going to arise. Loss of tax exemption for traditionalist ministries, the closing down of schools and social service organizations, and the professional purging of doctors, lawyers, and counselors who are traditionalists. And here on this particular topic, I want to be a bit more normative. Perhaps you thought I've been normative all along, but I'll be even more normative here and a bit more personal. My friend Andy Koppelman, who has long supported gay rights and same-sex marriage, has called the current stage of the culture wars battle over sexuality a cleanup operation. The rhetoric is often so strong that I feel at times that I'll end up being like Hiro Onoda, the Japanese soldier assigned to the Philippines during World War II, who refused to surrender for almost 30 years after the war had ended. And I suppose I share some affinities with Onoda. I'm half Japanese, and I used to be a military officer. But I'm not sure that I'll be the lone holdout at the end of this war. For one thing, I'm not sure that I've ever been fighting this war, even though my beliefs and values largely align with one side. Instead of being like Onoda, maybe I'm more akin to a civilian bystander that the putative victors need to do something about. But another reason that I don't think I'm like Onoda is that I don't really feel all that alone. I look around and see a lot of other people and a lot of other institutions that don't seem to be going away, and those institutions are doing a lot of good for society in education, social services, hospitals, mercy ministries, and other areas. So a few quick examples here. One is focused on the family, which I'd always thought of as being on the front lines of the culture wars. But if you're like me and you haven't paid attention to focus in the past few years or past decade, or the work of their new president, Jim Daly, you might be surprised at what you find. I'm not suggesting their substantive views have changed. Focus on the family is not in danger of being mistaken as the Protestant mainline. But the differences in modes of engagement are significant. Focus has gone from the days of Dobson pushing Colorado's infamous Amendment 2 to the days of Daly partnering with the Gill Foundation, a gay rights group, to help enact Colorado's anti-human trafficking legislation. Here's another example. I sit on the board of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, which has been on the front lines of the campus access issues and has been expelled from a handful of college and university campuses around the country. InterVarsity, as it turns out, is one of the more multi-ethnic traditionalist institutions. In California, over 70% of its students are students of color. And InterVarsity hasn't really been fighting the culture wars. Its focus has been elsewhere on ministry and missions. Since 1946, it's hosted a conference called Urbana that has drawn 300,000 participants and sent tens of thousands of students around the globe for work that includes sharing the Christian faith, but also includes serving the poor, building infrastructure, and helping the sick and dying. In 2012, half of the 15,000 Urbana participants were people of color. The next upcoming conference is in St. Louis at the end of December. And if you've never heard of Urbana, then let me make a serious invitation to you. Come join me and see it. Come see what a big group of traditionalists do when we get together. And I mean this invitation seriously, on the record today. You can stay at my house if you want to put up with three small children, too. So why do I highlight these examples now? We're a couple of months away from a Supreme Court decision that will likely constitutionalize state-recognized same-sex marriage. And as Doug Laycock has argued in a brief filed in those cases, filed in support of the same-sex petitioners, religious liberty challenges for traditionalists will intensify. We saw a preview of Doug's prediction in the exchange between Justice Alito and the Solicitor General that Sarah highlighted in an article last week. Justice Alito raised the Bob Jones question, and General Verrilli said it's going to be an issue. Now I think is a good time to be thinking about the implications of the Bob Jones question, whether we really think that Gordon College in 2015 is like Bob Jones in 1983, that InterVarsity is like a neo-Nazi group, and that Tim Keller is like the Grand Wizard of the Klan. I, with his permission, share that analogy. If we think there are meaningful differences, then now is a good time to think harder about the rhetoric fueling some of these debates. And I think one reason to think through these questions is that regardless of where the culture wars end up or what particular front we are fighting on in any given moment, we're going to have to at some point draw lines and set limiting principles. And I want to illustrate this with a vignette or a story that I think is going to lead my book, although I'm not totally set on it yet. And this is out of a class that I teach at WashU on the constitutional law around law and religion. And in this particular case, I was teaching the Establishment Clause cases around school funding, which are always a really interesting and pretty convoluted topic. At what point and how much funding can the government give to private religious schools? The key case is a 1947 decision involving buses and whether taxpayer dollars can reimburse Catholic parents for busing their kids to Catholic schools. And the intellectual puzzle is this. If you say that tax dollars can pay for buses, then what about textbooks and prayer books and Bibles and ministers? And if you say they can't, then what about public roads and crossing guards? In other words, the funding from the state is everywhere, and at what point do we draw the line about these particular institutions? So since I make a business of posing hypotheticals to students, I threw one out and I said, well, let's take the Catholic Church, which has gender norms that are out of step with some contemporary norms on gender. And so let's assume that this Catholic school finds itself in a city with more progressive gender norms, but it also decides that it wants to provide crossing guards to all private and public schools because it has evidence that fewer kids would die in the crosswalk. Can it refuse to withhold the dollars from the Catholic school? And so I'd expected some back and forth. That's the reason to throw out the hypothetical. But I was actually surprised when one student dug in pretty firmly. Yes, absolutely. The school has chosen to place itself outside the bounds of acceptable society, and it's not entitled to the services of the state. And so I said, well, what if the school catches on fire? Can the fire department refuse to answer the call? Yes, absolutely. The school can try to put out the fire on its own, but it's outside the boundaries of the state. And I said, well, what if there's an active shooter in the school? Should the SWAT team show up and stand down and wait for the shooter to finish? And the student said, I don't see why not. Now, this was, to be sure, a classroom hypothetical, but I want to point out that there is an internal logic to the student's answers, and there are ways in which, if one starts from the premise that government cannot support unpopular or dissenting or unorthodox positions, then there might be a desire, normatively or legally, to go all the way even to this extreme. I'm not suggesting that this is practically on the table. It's meant rhetorically and illustratively, but it does suggest that we need to think about what limiting principles are to come and how we frame the normative, the cultural, and the legal debate around those. So I, with that, look forward to your questions and discussion.